and a first cousin, once removed, of General Tojo, who was second in power in Japan only to His Imperial Majesty Emperor Hirohito. Captain Saikaku thought it not unlikely that when his assignment to the Kempeitai detachment to the military governor of Mindanao was over, Lieutenant Colonel Tange would write an enthusiastic efficiency report on him, suggesting that he was highly deserving of promotion. Lieutenant Colonel Tange occupied the former office of the mayor of Cagayan de Oro, to the right of the entrance foyer, and General Kurokawa Kenzo was in the office of the former provincial governor, to the left. Saikaku entered Tange's outer office, ignored Tange's sergeant, and walked to Tange's open door. "Good afternoon, Colonel," he said, saluting with something less than great precision. Then he walked inside and bowed, quickly, from the waist. "This, Captain Saikaku, has come to my attention," Lieutenant Colonel Tange said. "I would be very interested in your opinion of it." He handed Saikaku a sheet of paper on which was typewritten Brigadier General Wendell Fertig's Assumption of Command and Declaration of Martial Law Proclamation. Lieutenant Colonel Tange spoke English, but not as well as Captain Saikaku, who had studied the language for 6 years and then perfected it while a young lieutenant working for more than a year as a laborer in Hawaii. "The name is not familiar to me," Tange said, "and I checked, it is not on the roster of prisoner officers."
"My immediate reaction, sir, is that it is not what it purports to be," Saikaku said. "I'm sure the colonel has noticed that it is typewritten, not mimeographed, and that, more important, it is typed on previously used paper." "If it is not what it purports to be, Captain, what then is it?"
"I am guessing, of course, Colonel, and I will, of course, look into the matter. But my immediate reaction is that this was prepared by a former army clerk, familiar with the form of such a letter, and intended to fool us."
"Why a clerk and not an officer?"
"Officers do not usually know how to typewrite, sir."
"I don't like it," Tange said. "Could the Americans be setting up some kind of guerrilla force?"
"I respectfully suggest, sir, that what we should not do is grow excited over this, as whoever prepared this hopes we will do. As the colonel is well aware, we have had absolutely no indications of guerrilla activity of any kind."
"I don't like it," Tange repeated.
"Look into it immediately, if you please, and report what you find. I have not yet discussed this with General Kenzo. When I do, I would like to have something to tell him."
"I will attend to it immediately, sir."
20 minutes later, Captain Saikaku pulled the Lincoln up against a wooden gate set in a brick wall that surrounded a one-floor house on the outskirts of town. He sounded the horn, and a moment later, a soldier swung the gates inward. The house, previously occupied by a Filipino lawyer and his family, had been impressed into the service of the Kempeitai as a special prison. Shortly after the American surrender, Captain Saikaku had the junior officers and enlisted men of General Sharp's staff lined up so that he could conduct a personal inspection. Based on his year in Hawaii, he fancied himself a rather good judge of American character. From these, he selected a dozen Americans, 4 officers and 8 enlisted men, on the basis of his judgment that they would turn out to be both knowledgeable and malleable, and then he had them brought to the house behind the wall. He ordered them stripped and beaten each day for 3 days, and then, one by one, he examined them again. One of the officers and 3 of the enlisted men appeared to be properly conditioned, and he ordered their retention. The others were sent back to the POW enclosure. One of the enlisted men, a somewhat effeminate sergeant from Wisconsin, whom Saikaku suspected of being a sexual deviant, he ordered hung up naked by his heels overnight in the garage of the house behind the wall. In the morning, he ordered an electrical current to be passed through the sergeant's body by means of alligator clips attached to his scrotum and nostrils. While this was going on, he appeared in the garage, slapped the Japanese soldier applying the electrical current hard enough to knock him off his feet, and ordered the sergeant to be carried into the house and placed in one of the bedrooms. The next morning, he went to the bedroom and behaved in a very friendly manner to the sergeant, telling him he would do what he could to protect him from the soldiers, but in return, the sergeant would have to cooperate with him.
He then left the bedroom and gave orders that the sergeant was to be beaten with switches, not boards, twice a day until further orders. He was to be beaten painfully, not severely, with attention given to the soles of his feet and to his genitals. 3 days later he returned, professed outrage at the beatings, and otherwise behaved in a friendly manner. He then ordered a young Filipino of known deviant tendencies placed in the sergeant's bedroom. He also had the beating stopped, and he had them furnished with food, rice and chicken and bread, and a case of beer. The sergeant was thus given a choice. He could choose beatings, starvation, and possibly death, not only for himself but for his newfound friend, or he could choose confinement under reasonably pleasant conditions. He not surprisingly elected to be cooperative. "What the hell?" he said. "The war's over for me anyway, right?" Captain Saikaku entered the house and went to the sergeant's bedroom. The sergeant, as always, looked at him with frightened eyes, not sure if Saikaku was going to be friendly.
"Jerry," Captain Saikaku said,
"tell me about General Fatig."
The sergeant's eyes showed fear.
"Sir, I don't know—"
"Jerry, you promised me you would be cooperative."
"I swear to Christ, I never heard of a General Fatig."
"I would hate to think you are not telling me the truth."
"I give you my word of honor."
"The name means nothing to you at all."
"Not a thing. I swear it. If it did, I would tell you. You know that?"
Captain Saikaku nodded, turned on his heel, and left the bedroom. After leaving orders that the Filipino boy deviant was to be beaten in the presence of the sergeant, he returned to Lieutenant Colonel Tange's office. Although he would continue looking into the matter, he told him, he was at the moment convinced that Brigadier General Fertig was a figment of some Filipino army clerk's imagination, and there was no cause for concern. 3. Near Mangkayo, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 1615 hours, 11 October, 1942. They walked all day, slowly, taking a 5-minute break each hour. But the trails through the thick vegetation were steep, in some places slippery, and the heat was debilitating. And then, all of a sudden, they came out of the jungle into a clearing. The Mexican bandit, at whose heels Weston had been walking, stepped aside and pointed at a rather large, thatch-roofed Filipino house built on stilts. Sitting in a rattan chair on what could be called the porch of the house sat a tall, sturdy-looking man wearing a khaki uniform. A silver, 5-pointed star, the rank insignia of a brigadier general, adorned each of his collar points. He was also wearing a red goatee and a wide-brimmed straw hat. A Thompson submachine gun lay at his feet.
"General Fertig," the Mexican bandit said.
Behind him, Weston heard Everly, bringing up the rear of the column, mutter in disgust or disappointment,
"Shit."
"Wait here," Weston ordered. He walked across the clearing, aware of the general's eyes on him, and climbed the steep stairs, more like a ladder than a flight of stairs, and then walked across the porch to within 6 feet of the red-goateed man in the chair. The general met his eyes, but there was no expression on his face. Weston saluted.
"First Lieutenant Weston, James B., USMC, sir."
The general returned his salute.
"Have your men been fed, Lieutenant?"
"No, sir."
"Are there other officers in your party?"
"No, sir."
"Sergeant!"
the general called, raising his voice. Another Filipino wearing baggy white cotton trousers and a U.S. Army campaign hat came onto the porch from inside the house.
"Sir?"
"See that this officer's men are fed," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"And when you have done that, please bring us some of the cold pork."
"Yes, sir."
"Are you a drinking man, Lieutenant?"
The question surprised Weston.
"Yes, sir."
"And a couple of beers, please," the general said.
"Yes, sir,"
the Filipino said. Fertig met Weston's eyes again.
"Welcome to headquarters, United States Forces in the Philippines, Lieutenant. Weston, you said?"
"Yes, sir."
"Thank you, sir." You will, from this moment, consider yourself and your men under my command.
That announcement made Weston uncomfortable. His imagination shifted into high gear.
What this guy may be, probably is a staff officer who went around the bend. He was unable to accept that the army got the shit kicked out of it, that the Japanese have won the battle for the Philippines hands down. That must have been even tougher to accept for someone of senior rank with 20 years or so in the service than it was for somebody like me. And unable to accept the facts, he's now living up some fantasy where he's still a general. The U.S. Army in the Philippines still exists, and any moment the aid will appear, galloping to our rescue like the cavalry in the movies. Yes, sir, he said. Things are a bit primitive around here at the moment, Furtick said. We hope to improve on them.
Yes, sir.
Please tell me how you came here, Lieutenant.
One of my men, Sergeant Everly, sir, was contacted by one of your men while he was on patrol. He showed Sergeant Everly your,
proclamation? Furtick asked.
Yes, sir, your proclamation, nailed to a telephone pole. He, Everly, brought it to me, and then your man led us here.
Mm-hmm. And what I was really asking, Lieutenant, was how you came to Mindanao. Presumably you were formerly assigned to the 4th Marines on Bataan?
On Corregidor, yes, sir.
And you somehow got off Corregidor and decided that it was your duty not to surrender when Corregidor inevitably fell?
Yes, sir.
Well, at least he knows that we lost Bataan and Corregidor.
Furtick looked at him, obviously waiting for him to continue.
I was a pilot, sir, Weston heard himself saying. I mean, I am an aviator. I was stranded in the Philippines and assigned to the 4th Marines as a supernumerary officer. My commanding officer sent me to Bataan looking for supplies.
Why is it important to tell this man what really happened? Am I looking for his approval? His forgiveness?
I was provided with $5,000 and a Spanish-speaking sergeant, sir. I wasn't ordered to desert. That was my decision. But I believe Major Paulson hoped I would not return, that I would try to get out of the Philippines to Australia.
Furtick nodded.
We attempted to rent a boat, Weston went on. We found one. And then the Filipinos on the boat attempted to murder us.
Banditry and piracy have a long history in the Philippines, Furtick said. What happened?
We killed them, Weston blurted, aware of that, but unable to stop. Everly killed the one who was trying to cut my throat, and then we killed the others and threw their bodies into the sea.
Where was that? Furtick replied.
He seemed neither surprised nor shocked.
Right off the Bataan Peninsula, sir.
It was just you and your sergeant at first? You picked up the others en route here?
Yes, sir, that's about it.
You're apparently a resourceful officer, Lieutenant. It must have been difficult to obtain the necessary food and water and, of course, the charts to make a voyage such as you have made. You are to be commended.
Sir, it wasn't that way. Weston confessed, uncomfortably. We had neither rations nor charts.
But?
We found a cabin cruiser adrift in the passage between Lubang Island and... I can't remember the other island, a little one, uninhabited.
Ambil Island, Furtick furnished. I know the passage.
Tell me about the cabin cruiser. It was, a locally built copy of a Chriscraft.
Did it have a name?
Yes, sir. Yet again.
The general looked pained. His eyebrows rose, and then he shrugged in what Weston thought was sadness and resignation.
You're very observant, Lieutenant, the general said, his voice level. Yet again was a locally built copy of a Chriscraft. It belonged, apparently, past tense, to friends of mine, Joseph and Harriet Dennison. He was the Chrysler dealer in Manila.
Was there any sign of them, by any chance?
In the master cabin, sir, there were two bodies, a middle-aged couple. The woman was in the bed, She was apparently killed when the boat was attacked by Japanese aircraft. There were bullet holes.
He was interrupted by a Filipino woman who thrust at him a plate of pork chunks in rice and some kind of sauce. When he took it, she handed him a fork and a cup, made from bamboo.
"The pork is very nice," Furtick said. "The beer, unfortunately, seems to be proof that a civil engineer and a Navy chief who don't know what they're doing should not try to brew beer."
Weston wolfed down the pork and rice.
"There's more," Furtick said, "but I would advise waiting an hour or so, when you haven't been eating normally."
"That was fine, sir. Thank you. It'll hold me for a while."
"You were telling me about what you found on the, yet again."
Weston tried to remember where he had broken off the story, and then resumed.
"The woman was apparently killed in a strafing attack. The man shot himself in the temple. The boat was out of fuel."
Furtick closed his eyes and said nothing. Weston took a sip of the beer. It was warm and thick, and reminded Weston of a disastrous attempt to make home brew in his fraternity house at college.
"There was canned food aboard, sir," he went on, "and water, and charts. We took it all and started out for here."
"Leaving everything as you found it aboard the Yet Again?"
"No, sir. I mean, we buried the bodies at sea, in blankets weighted down with batteries. We didn't burn the boat. Everly thought it would attract attention, and I agreed."
"Inasmuch as doing so under the circumstances obviously posed a risk to you, it was quite decent of you to bury the Denison's lieutenant."
Weston could think of no reply to make.
"I knew them rather well. Nice people. He was the exception to the rule that you never can trust anyone in the retail automobile business. Mrs. Furtick and I used to see a good deal of them at the yacht club."
"You were stationed in Manila, sir?"
"I was a civil engineer in Manila. I had the foresight to send Mrs. Furtick home when I entered the army."
"Yes, sir."
"Though few others, including, sadly, the Denisons, were willing to face that unpleasant fact. I knew there was no way we could really resist the Japanese when they came here. Roosevelt believes the Germans are the greater threat. Our war effort will be directed primarily against them. The Pacific and the Japanese will be a secondary effort. There never was going to be the aid that everybody was talking about."
Sir, you said, when you entered the army?"
"I was commissioned as a captain, Corps of Engineers, Reserve, with another chap, Ralph Frelick. He was commissioned a lieutenant, and we spent the early days of the war blowing things up. Bridges, railroads, that sort of thing. Interesting experience, taking down in an hour what you had spent months, in several cases, years, building."
"Yes, sir."
"The last I heard of Frelick, he was a captain, and he had his hands on a 40-foot boat, sail and diesel, and was headed for Indochina. When the end came, I was here. I decided that I did not want to be a prisoner, and since I have a hard head, I decided I could cause the Japanese more trouble by organizing a guerrilla operation here than trying to get out. If I had made it out, and the idea of trying to sail 2,000 miles in a small boat to Australia seems iffy at best, I suspected that the army would have a reserve lieutenant colonel who is a civil engineer supervise the construction of officer clubs."
Furtick looked into Weston's eyes. Then he flipped up one of his collar points with a brigadier general's star pinned to it.
"Would you be wondering by any chance, lieutenant, about these?"
"Yes, sir, I was," Weston said after a moment.
"I've lived in the Philippines a long time, lieutenant. I know the people, and I know, not as well as I know the Filipinos, the military mind. If I had signed my proclamation, Lieutenant Colonel, Corps of Engineers, Reserve, it would have been pissing in the wind. I think you're proof of that, lieutenant."
"Sir?" Weston asked, confused.
"If my proclamation had announced that Lieutenant Colonel Furtick, Civil Engineer, U.S. Army Reserve, was the senior officer of U.S. forces in the Philippines, would you have paid any attention to it? To put a point on it, would you have come looking for me?"
"Sir, I was getting pretty desperate. I probably would have come," Weston said uneasily.
at least to have a look. And if you found a lieutenant colonel wearing a straw hat and a goatee, what do you think you'd have done? You'd have gone right back in the bush, perhaps, avoiding the lunatic?
Weston shrugged uncomfortably.
That's exactly what I would have done. Instead, you didn't see me. You saw that general star, and that impressed you, right? I might look a little strange in my straw hat and beard, but the cogent fact, right, was that I was wearing a general star, and you gave me the benefit of the doubt.
Yes, sir.
Let me give you a little lecture in military law, Lieutenant Weston. Inasmuch as I am what the books call the senior officer of the line present, which means that I am serving in one of the branches of the armed forces which engages in combat, that includes the infantry, the cavalry, the artillery, the engineers, the air corps, and, oddly enough, even the signal corps, but excludes the medical corps, the chaplain's corps, the finance corps, etc. You following me?
Yes, sir, I think so.
Inasmuch as I am a lieutenant colonel of the line, the Congress of the United States, in its wisdom, has given me command over all lieutenant colonels of the line, regular or reserve, junior to me, my date of rank, and every other officer in an inferior grade, a lieutenant commander in the Navy, for example, or, should one wander in here, a full bird colonel of the medical corps, or, to put a point on it, a Marine Corps first lieutenant who has, in fact, wandered in here.
Yes, sir, Weston said, because he could think of nothing else to say.
My order to you that as of this moment you and your men are under my command is perfectly valid.
Yes, sir, I suppose it is.
You took it a lot easier when you thought I was a brigadier general, didn't you? No question, just, yes, sir, general.
That's not wholly true, but he's made his point.
Yes, sir, General, Weston said with a smile. I had a Moro silversmith hammer these out for me, Furtick said, flipping one of his silver-starred color points again. Because the Filipinos I intend to recruit will follow a general. They would not follow a lieutenant colonel. And I did not wish to deliver my little lecture about the small print in military law to every American serviceman I came across.
I understand, sir.
In the absence of any other officer able or willing to assume command of American forces in the Philippines, I have done so. I'll deal with the subject of my self-promotion with my superior headquarters at some later time.
Yes, sir.
Any questions, Lieutenant Weston?
No, sir.
That's strange. I thought an intelligent, curious young man like you would be interested to know the current strength of United States forces in the Philippines.
Yes, sir, I am.
Right now, the officer corps is three officers strong. It consists of myself and you and Captain Charles Hedges. He is my chief of staff. At the moment, he's out looking for a radio and mobile rations, which means swine that can be taken along with us under their own power should the Japanese get too close for comfort.
And enlisted men?
Counting the ones that came in with you, 16 Americans. So far as the Philippine element of USFIP is concerned, I have 11 commissioned officers and approximately 225 enlisted men. Sometime in the near future, we hope to equip each of the enlisted men with a firearm. At the moment, approximately half are armed with machetes.
Yes, sir.
Reliable intelligence has reached our G2 section, which at the moment means me, that there are other small units such as yours who have declined to surrender here on Mindanao and elsewhere in the islands. Efforts are being made to contact them and place them under the command of USFIP.
Yes, sir.
Reliable intelligence indicates that two such units with a total strength of 165 are on their way here from Cebu at this moment. More are expected shortly. It is my belief that USFIP will grow rapidly in size, like a snowball rolling down a hill in Vermont.
Weston smiled at the analogy.
One of our problems is officers, Furtick said. Of your men, are there any you could in good conscience recommend for a direct commission.
Everly, Weston said without hesitation.
Just the one.
Yes, sir.
You are authorized to offer him a commission as a second lieutenant infantry U.S. Army Reserve. If he accepts, I will swear him in.
He's what they call an old-breed Marine general, Weston said, smiling. A China Marine. I don't know what he'll think about becoming an Army lieutenant.
Fertig ignored the reply.
Our second problem is establishing radio communications with Australia. I don't suppose that you are a radio man, or any of your men?
No, sir, but I have a degree in electrical engineering.
Interesting! Fascinating. That would ordinarily be enough for me to name you signal officer of USFIP, Fertig said. But I already have one.
Or will shortly, as soon as I commission him. Probably this afternoon, after you have a word with your man Everly, I'll commission them together. He's currently a private soldier named Ball, but he's a radio operator.
There was a disconcerting aura about the whole conversation, at once amusing and frightening. It was simultaneously insane and utterly practical.
It might sound insane, but obviously this man intends to do exactly what he says he's going to do. And there is a method to his madness.
When our reinforcements attach themselves to us, Fertig said, obviously it would be best if they didn't quite understand how recently our officers were commissioned, or received their assignments in the command structure, or promoted.
I take the general's point, Weston said.
I would hate to think that you are mocking me, Weston.
No, sir. Weston replied immediately and sincerely. That was not my intention, General.
Fertig looked into his eyes again.
Good. It would be awkward if I thought my G2, an officer I personally promoted to captain, was mocking me. It would suggest he did not have faith in me.
Has the General given any consideration to the assignment of Lieutenant Everly? Weston asked.
For the time being, he should be your deputy, Fertig said seriously.
And then a smile curled his lips.
Maybe between, what was it you said, an old-breed China Marine and an airplane-less pilot, we can come up with a half-decent intelligence officer.
We'll try, sir, Weston said.
Do you have a razor in your kit, Weston?
No, sir. Then you may use mine. I think one bearded officer is enough for USFIP.
Aye, aye, sir. You may go in my quarters, Captain, and have a shave, and then I suggest you have a word with your man Everly, Fertig said.
Aye, aye, sir, Weston said, and stood up. By your leave, General?
You know, that's the first time anyone said aye, aye to me. Nice. You are dismissed, Captain.
Weston saluted, did an about-face, and then walked into General Fertig's quarters. Inside the house, Weston found, neatly laid out on a rattan table, a round, magnifying mirror in a chrome frame, a leather-covered box holding 7 old-fashioned straight razors, a leather strop, a shaving brush, and a wooden jar of shaving soap. The soap was gray, obviously not what originally filled the jar.
There are 2 ways to look at this. One way, the United States forces in the Philippines is so fucked up we don't even have soap. On the other hand, USFIP is resourceful enough to make its own soap, and the goateed madman on the porch is confident enough to be worried about the appearance of his officers. And, since I have never held a straight razor in my hand before, I am liable to die for my country of a slit throat acquired while I was attempting to set a good example for the enlisted men.
There was a battered aluminum bowl half full of water. He dipped the shaving brush into it, attempted to make suds in the soap dish, and was astonished at his success. The bubbles were gray, but they were bubbles. He painted his cheek with them and, very carefully, began to hack away at his beard. Fertig's Filipino sergeant came into the house while he was working on his chin and stood silently watching him while he finished shaving. Then he handed Weston a campaign hat. Pinned on it were the double silver bars of a captain. They were unquestionably of local manufacture. The marks of a silversmith's hammer were clear. Weston put on the battered, broad-brimmed hat and looked at himself in the mirror. The hat was several sizes too small, but if he pushed it forward on his head, it would probably stay on, and it even gave him sort of a rakish appearance that he did not find hard to take. That made him think of something. He went into the baggy pocket of his cotton trousers and pulled out a tied-together handkerchief. In addition to other small items he hadn't needed for a long time, including golden dress shirt studs, it held a small, gold USMC globe and anchor. At one time, he'd worn it on a fore-and-aft cap that he had last seen on the rock. With some difficulty, he managed to pin the Marine Corps insignia onto the campaign hat above the captain's bars. The Filipino sergeant was smiling at him.
"Do you speak English?"
"Yes, sir."
"Would you take me to my men?"
"Yes, sir."
Sergeant Everly was sitting with his back against a tree, an empty plate on the ground beside him. Weston thought at first he was asleep, but as he approached, Everly pushed himself away from the tree and looked at him. Weston gestured with his finger for Everly to join him. The other members of Weston's weary would-be warriors who had noticed the campaign hat and Weston's now clean-shaven face looked at them with only mild, even listless curiosity. Weston thought he knew their thoughts. There's no apparent immediate danger. We are being fed. What else could be important?
"Nice cover, Mr. Weston," Sergeant Everly said, indicating the hat.
"General Fertig gave it to me," Weston replied.
"I never saw a general with a beard before," Everly said evenly.
"He's an engineer officer who decided he didn't want to surrender and that he did want to make trouble for the Japanese," Weston said, realizing as he spoke that he had decided not to tell Everly that Fertig had promoted himself to brigadier general. Everly did not respond.
"He knows the islands, speaks Spanish," Weston said. "This whole thing just started. There's apparently at least two groups of people like us on their way here."
Everly nodded his head and waited for Weston to continue.
"Under military law, as he is the senior officer of the line in the area, we fall under his command."
Everly nodded again.
"He's made me a temporary captain. He asked me if I thought you could handle a temporary commission as a lieutenant, and I told him I thought you'd make a pretty good lieutenant."
Everly cocked his head when he heard that, and took the time to think it over.
"There were a lot of China Marines in Shanghai who'd served in Haiti, Mr. Weston," he said. "They told me they had what they called the constabulary down there. A lot of Marine non-coms were officers in the constabulary. Is this something like that?"
"Something. You would be commissioned into the Army as an officer of United States forces in the Philippines."
"Not in the Corps. You're wearing the Corps insignia."
"I don't think General Fertig will object to my wearing the Corps insignia, or if you or any other Marine wears it. But your commission would be in the Army."
"Sure, Mr. Weston, why not? I think I could handle it."
"I'm sure you will," Weston said. "Come on, I'll introduce you to the General."
"Can I ask you a question, Mr. Weston?"
"Certainly."
"Is this General Fertig going to be able to do any damage to the Japs?"
"Yes," Weston replied. "I'm sure he is."
"I'll be damned. I really believe that."
"We don't have doodly shit to fight with," Everly said. "What's this general going to do about that?"
"Well, first we have to get organized. You and I are going to be his G2 section. He's got an army radio operator whose orders are to find a radio and get in touch with General MacArthur in Australia."
"I did a little work for intelligence in Shanghai," Everly said.
"You did?" Weston replied, surprise evident in his voice.
"Worked for Captain Banning, the S2.
Weston searched his mind for a face to go with Captain Banning, but failed. Yet he judged from the tone of Everly's voice that he was being told the truth.
"Doing what?"
"Keeping an eye on the Japs, troop strength, locations of units, counting artillery pieces and trucks, that kind of stuff."
"Espionage," Weston said without thinking.
"Nah, more like reconnaissance. I never took off my uniform or anything like that.
I never thought I could get away with trying to pass myself off as a Jap.
I'm surprised, Weston thought aloud, that they didn't have you working in intelligence on the Rock.
I don't think anybody but maybe the colonel and the exec knew I ever worked for Captain Banning.
What about Captain Banning? Weston asked, confused, adding, I don't remember seeing him on the Rock.
The first time we came under fire when the Japs first landed, long before we pulled back to the Rock, Captain Banning got hit. Artillery. He took enough shrapnel so they didn't dare move him right away, so he found himself behind the Jap lines. Then the army started shelling where he was hiding. Didn't hurt him much, but the concussion got his eyes. Or maybe his brain. Anyway, it made him blind. When they finally got him through the Jap lines into the hospital on the Rock, he was in pretty bad shape. Finally, they evacuated him on one of the submarines that came to the Rock to take the gold off.
Christ, Weston said.
And I guess he never said anything about me to anybody, Everly said, adding, he was a hell of a good Marine officer.
From you, that's quite a compliment. I wonder what you think of me.
I wish I knew more about intelligence than I do, Weston said. What I really know is nothing. I'm an airplane driver.
You'll do all right, Mr. Weston, Everly said.
You learn fast.
I'll be damned. I've been complimented. And I don't think Everly would say that unless he meant it.
Come on, I'll introduce you to the general, Weston said.
I never talked to a general before,
Everly said as he bent over to pick up his Thompson.
4. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 0625 hours, 9 October, 1942. Breakfast in the officers' mess of United States Forces in the Philippines consisted of freshly squeezed pineapple juice, fresh pineapple chunks, and bananas. Brigadier General Wendell Fertig, sitting at the head of the table, apologized to the members of the mess for not having coffee, bread, eggs, bacon, or ham, but as soon as he acquired a G-4, supply officer, providing such necessities would be high on his list of priorities. Present at the table were Captain James B. Weston, Second Lieutenant Percy L. Everly, and Second Lieutenant Robert Ball. Weston noted that Everly and Ball had also acquired broad-brimmed campaign hats, onto which were pinned brass Second Lieutenant's bars, and Everly's had a USMC insignia pinned to it. Like Weston himself, Everly had obviously kept his insignia even when it made no sense at all to keep his tattered, worn beyond any utility, uniform.
Why is that little piece of metal so important to us?
God knows, there are no impressionable blondes around to dazzle with our membership in the Corps. So why is it important to us, in these circumstances, that no one mistake us for soldiers?
2 additional officers appeared at the mess. That is to say, the porch of General Fertig's quarters trembled as someone started up the ladder-like stairs. When they looked, 2 men appeared. One was dressed like General Fertig, in baggy white cotton shirt and trousers and a crude straw hat. He had a Thompson 45 caliber submachine gun slung from his shoulder. The second was wearing a battered khaki uniform. The sleeves of his khaki shirt, onto the collar points of which was pinned the railroad tracks of a captain and the crossed flags of the Signal Corps, had been torn off above the elbows, and his khaki trousers had been torn off above the knees. He wore a pith helmet and a web belt, from which hung a 1911 A1 45 automatic in a leather holster, green with mildew. He had a 1917 Enfield 30-06 rifle slung from his shoulder. He carried a rucksack, obviously heavy, in his hand.
"Good morning, General," the first man said, saluting. The uniformed captain, after a moment's hesitation, also saluted. Fertig returned the salute.
"Introductions are apparently in order," he said. "Gentlemen, my chief of staff, Captain Charles Hedges. Hedges, this is Captain Weston, a Marine officer who has placed himself and his men, including Lieutenant Everly, under our command. You know Lieutenant Ball."
Hedges wordlessly shook Weston's and Everly's hands.
"General, this is Captain Buchanan," Hedges said, "late of General Sharp's headquarters."
"I believe I met the captain," Fertig said.
"Yes, sir," Buchanan said. "You were,
colonel at the time. A lieutenant colonel, to be precise, Fertig said, ignoring what could have been an accusation. How are you, Buchanan?
Very well, sir. Thank you.
Can I offer you some breakfast?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Sergeant!
Fertig called, raising his voice. The Filipino sergeant appeared. Will you get these gentlemen some breakfast, please?
Yes, sir.
Sit down, please, gentlemen, Fertig said, and then looked intently at Buchanan. You're aware, of course, that General Sharp was ordered by General Wainwright to surrender his command to the Japanese?
Yes, sir.
Do I correctly infer by your presence here that you saw it as your duty not to enter into Japanese captivity?
Yes, sir.
And you are willing to place yourself... Are you alone, Captain?
No, sir. I have 8 men, Americans, with me.
Are you willing to place yourself and your men under my command?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to United States Forces in the Philippines, Fertig said, leaning across the table to shake Buchanan's hand. And after you've had your breakfast, we'll have a private chat.
Yes, sir.
In the meantime... A curiosity overwhelms me. What does the bag contain? It seems unusually heavy.
It's an M-94, sir, Buchanan said. Device, cryptographic M-94.
Ah, enlighten me, Fertig said. Buchanan put the bag on the table, unfastened the straps, and took from it a small metal box. On the top was a small brass plate. Secret. Device, cryptographic, Model 94. Serial number 145. It is absolutely forbidden to remove this device from its assigned cryptographic facility. Secret.
Things collapsed so quickly, sir, that I didn't have a chance to destroy this, Buchanan said. I didn't want the Japs to have a chance to see how it works. They could have, if I had only rendered it inoperable, by shooting it up or burning it. So I took it with me, with the idea of throwing it into the sea. If I buried it somewhere and was subsequently captured, the Japanese are very good at interrogation.
This thing works? Fertig asked.
Yes, sir.
Frankly, Captain, I was hoping your heavy bag was laden with $20 gold coins, Fertig said. But now, this device is literally worth more to USFIP than its weight in gold. Ball. How far away are we from having an operating radio station?
If Sergeant Ramirez can get that generator to run on alcohol, maybe we can give it a shot this afternoon, sir.
I hate to break up our festive breakfast, gentlemen, Fertig said, but Captain Buchanan, Lieutenant Ball, and I have some important work to do.
5. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, Davao, Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 15:15 hours, 10 October, 1942. There being no other pressing official business for them to attend to, both the G2 of USFIP, Captain James B. Weston, and his deputy, Second Lieutenant Percy L. Everly, had spent most of the day in the USFIP Communications Center, a hastily erected lean-to 200 yards from General Fertig's quarters, watching the USFIP signal officer, Second Lieutenant Robert Ball, and his chief radio operator, Sergeant Ignacio Lamadrid, Philippine Army, attempt to establish radio communication with United States forces in Australia. Unlike the others, Sergeant Lamadrid had no previous military service prior to joining USFIP. He was 17 years old and in high school when the war came. He was shocked by the defeat of American and Filipino forces by the Japanese, but even more shocked by the brutality the Japanese applied to Filipino prisoners of war, despite Japanese public announcements that Japan and the Philippines were now partners in the greater Asian co-prosperity sphere. When he saw General Fertig's proclamation nailed to a telephone pole near his home, he set out to join him. He thought he might be useful. When he arrived, he spoke with Captain Hedges. Even though Lamadrid was among the first Filipino volunteers, Captain Hedges did not seem particularly interested in the services of a 5'2", 112-pound, 17-year-old Filipino who admitted he had never so much as held a firearm in his hands.
And then La Madrid suggested he might be useful fixing radios. He had been almost halfway through the International Correspondence Course in radio telephony when the war came. He was sworn into the Philippine Army as a private shortly thereafter and promoted to PFC a week later when he came to headquarters carrying a sound motion picture projector that had been hidden from the Japanese. He said he could probably make a radio transmitter from it. Captain Hedges informed PFC La Madrid that if he was successful, he would be a sergeant. USFIP already had a shortwave receiver. If La Madrid could make a transmitter, and if they could come up with a generator to power both of them, they would have a radio station. That certainly was worth sergeant's stripes, even if at the moment there were no chevrons in the supply warehouse to actually issue. For that matter, there was no supply warehouse. A generator had come into being when another Filipino sergeant, this one an actual soldier, managed to make an engine run on alcohol that was designed to run on gasoline. The alcohol was produced from pineapples and coconuts in a still constructed from salvaged automobile parts. The transmitter worked. Proof came via the receiver. That was good enough for the chief of staff, USFIP, to make good on the promised promotion to sergeant, with actual chevrons to follow later. How well the transmitter worked was another question, and after almost 24 hours of transmitting for 3 minutes on the hour without a reply, it became a disturbing one. A message had been encoded with a Model 94 cryptographic device. This was then transmitted in 5-character words after the address sent in the clear. MFS for U.S. Forces Australia, repeated, followed by 3 lines of 5 5-character groups each, repeated once, followed by MFS standing by for U.S. Forces Australia, repeated. The message was tapped out on a radio telegraph key from Sergeant La Madrid's International Correspondence Corps lesson materials as many times as possible within a 3-minute period. 3 considerations had determined that length of time. 1 was the possibility that the Japanese would hear the message and, by a process known as triangulation, locate the transmitter. The 2nd was that the supply of alcohol for the transmitter was in short supply. The 3rd was that if its alcohol fuel damaged the generator, there was no spare. When there was no reply all day, it seemed logical to assume that despite Sergeant La Madrid's best efforts, he had been unable to jury-rig a transmitter that would reach the 3,000-plus miles to Australia. 6. Signal Section, Office of the Military Governor for Mindanao, Cagayan de Oro, Misamis Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 1600 hours, 10 October, 1942. When Captain Matsuo Saikaku marched into his office, Lieutenant Hideyori rose from behind his desk, placed his hands, fingers extended and together, against the seam of his khaki trousers, and bowed from the waist. Hideyori's office formerly belonged to the general manager of the Mindanao branch office of the Mackay Telephone and Telegraph Company. As he stood up, a large wall clock bearing the Mackay logotype began to strike the hour.
"I understand you have intercepted some kind of radio message?"
Saikaku demanded after he had returned the bow.
"Yes, sir."
Saikaku impatiently put out his hand. Hideyori handed him a sheet of paper. MFS for U.S. Forces Australia, repeated, followed by 3 lines of 5 5-character groups each, repeated, followed by MFS standing by for U.S. Forces Australia, repeated.
"That message is being transmitted hourly, sir, in the 20-meter band," Hideyori said.
"For how many hours?"
"The first message we intercepted was at 10 o'clock this morning, sir. They send the message repeatedly for a period of 3 minutes.
"Do you know from where?"
"No, sir."
"I was led to believe, Hideyori, that it is within the capability of competent signals people to locate the site of a transmitter by a process known as triangulation. Have I been misinformed?"
"No, sir."
"Has this triangulation detection process begun?"
"No, sir. There is some difficulty with 2 of the trucks, sir."
"What sort of difficulty?"
"Mechanical difficulty, sir."
"I really didn't think it would be spiritual difficulty, Hideyori."
"Mechanical, sir, as opposed to electrical. I have been informed that mechanical trouble will be remedied first thing tomorrow."
"Who told you this?"
Captain Kuroshio of the transportation section, sir. Be so good as to get Captain Kuroshio on the telephone, Hideyori. Yes, sir. Lieutenant Hideyori sat down, hastily consulted a mimeographed telephone book, dialed a number, spoke briefly with whoever answered, and then handed the telephone to Captain Saikaku.
Captain Kuroshio is being called to the phone, sir, he reported.
Saikaku took the telephone and waited, an impatient look on his face, until Captain Kuroshio came on the line. This is Captain Saikaku of the Kempe Tai, he announced. Lieutenant Hideyori informs me you are in the process of repairing two trucks. These trucks are required for a Kempe Tai operation. Required immediately. I want the necessary repairs to them begun immediately and continued until the trucks are operating, if that means your mechanics work through the night. Do you understand me?
He listened to the reply and then hung up.
As soon as the trucks are made available to you, Hideyori, he ordered, I want a man around the clock. The sooner we locate this station, the sooner we can shut it down.
Yes, sir.
What is your opinion of the message, the code?
I don't know what you mean, sir.
How soon can I expect to know what message these people are sending?
Sir, I took the liberty of sending the message to the Signals Intelligence Branch in Manila, asking them to attempt to decrypt the message.
You did this on your own authority?
Yes, sir. I believed it to be the thing to do.
You are to be commended on your initiative, Hideyori, Saikaku said.
Thank you, sir.
Be so good as to inform the Signals Intelligence Branch that there is Kempe Tai interest in this message.
Yes, sir.
And inform them that as a suggestion to help in their decryption efforts, you better write this down, Hideyori, that the message may contain the words Fertig, Brigadier, General, and U.S. Forces. Fertig is a name. The other words may be abbreviated.
I'm sure Signals Intelligence Branch will be pleased to have your suggestion, sir.
As soon as you have word on your trucks, or from Signals Intelligence, or of any development at all, inform me. Call my office. They will know where to locate me.
Yes, sir.
What we have here, Hideyori, is a weed. If we pull it from the earth now, that will be the end of it. If it is allowed to grow, it will become an increasing nuisance.
I understand, sir.
One final thing, Hideyori. Have your radio operators on the watch for messages addressed to MFS.
I have already ordered that, sir.
Good, Saikaku said, then turned and walked out of Lieutenant Hideyori's office. 7. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 1815 hours, 10 October 1942. Lieutenant Ball heard through his earphones the sound of the carrier and then a string of dots and dashes. His heart beating and with tears in his eyes, he wrote down the letters. MFS, KFS, repeated, followed by two lines of 4-5 character groups, each repeated, followed by, in the clear, KFS, CLR, repeated. Prior to his attachment to headquarters, USFIP, Ball had been a radio operator. He recognized the call sign of the answering station.
That's not Australia. It's a Navy station. I think Hawaii.
The message, when decoded, was brief. Stand by at 0600 your time. 8. Lieutenant Ball erred in part. While KFS was indeed a Navy radio station, it was not in Hawaii, but rather at the U.S. Navy base, Mare Island, near San Francisco. And there, the radio message had attracted the interest of a veteran chief radioman.
What the hell is this, Chief?
19-year-old radioman third class Daniel J. Miller, USN, asked, handing it to Dugan.
It's been coming in every hour on the hour in the 20-meter band, since yesterday.
The chief examined the message.
Whatever it is, he said, it was encoded on an old Model 94. That second code group means emergency SOI.
What's a Model 94?
An old-time crypto machine. They don't use them anymore, the chief said thoughtfully. Maybe the Japs captured one on Wake Island or someplace and are fucking with us.
What's an emergency SOI?
It means you don't have a valid signal operating instruction, so use the emergency one. The chief said absently, and then, thinking aloud, and maybe they ain't.
Maybe aren't what? fucking with us.
Then what the hell is this? Miller asked.
I don't know, the chief said. But I'm going to find out.
He consulted a typewritten list of telephone numbers taped to the slide in his desk, found the number of a communications section of the Presidio at San Francisco Army Base, and dialed it.
Camo, Sergeant Havel.
Chief Dugan, let me speak to Sergeant Pedwell.
What can the Army do for the Navy?
You're always telling me what hot shits you doggies are.
Statement of fact, Chief.
If I was to send you something encrypted on a Model 94, could you work it?
If I had a Model 94, I could. What's this?
You got one or not?
Yeah, there's one in the vault. I saw it last week and wondered what the hell we were still doing with it.
I'm going to send a fine young man named Miller over there with a message that needs decryption. Out of school. Okay, Pedwell?
What kind of message?
Use the emergency code, Chief Dugan said. Whoever sent this didn't have a valid SOI.
What's this all about?
When I find out, I'll tell you. But in the meantime, just do it and keep it under your hat, okay?
Ah, what the hell. Why not?
Thanks, Speedwell.
2 hours later, Radioman 3rd Miller was back from the Presidio with a blank, sealed, business-size envelope. When Chief Dugan opened it, he found a single sheet of typewritten paper inside. We have the hot poop from the hot Yanks in the Fills. Fertig, Brig Gen. Dugan handed it to Radioman 3rd Miller.
What's this mean?
Miller asked.
It could mean the Japs found a Model 94 and are fucking with us, Chief Dugan said. And it could mean it's for real.
He refolded the sheet of paper and put it back in the envelope.
The next time these people come on the air, send them stand by at 0600 your time, Chief Dugan said, and stood up. I'll be back as soon as I get back, he said.
Where are you going, in case somebody asks?
I'm going to tell the Admiral how to run the war, Chief Dugan said.
I mean, really?
Chief Petty Officers never lie, son. Write that on the palm of your hand so you never forget it, Chief Dugan said, put on his jacket and hat, and left the radio room.
Long time no see, Dugan,
Rear Admiral F. Winston Bloomer, USN, said.
You can spell that either S-E-E or S-E-A.
Coffee?
Thank you, sir, Dugan said.
The Admiral and the Chief went back a long way to when the Admiral had been a Lieutenant J.G. Commo officer on an old four-stacker tin can and the Chief had been a radioman striker. Dugan handed Admiral Bloomer the envelope, then helped himself to a cup of coffee from the Admiral's thermos.
Okay, what is it?
The Admiral asked.
Somebody's transmitting that on the 20-meter band for a couple of minutes every hour on the hour. It was encoded on a Model 94, no SOI.
A Model 94? They haven't used those for years. Japanese playing with us? They captured one somewhere, Wake Island maybe, or in the Philippines?
It may be the real thing.
What do you want to do, Dugan?
I want to find out if there is a Brigadier General named Fertig.
In other words, you want me to go to Naval Intelligence for you?
I've got a pal who can find out for me in a hurry.
Why does that make me uncomfortable? Admiral Bloomer asked, adding, Faster than ONI?
The Office of Naval Intelligence.
Who does your pal work for, the President?
The Secretary of the Navy has an administrative assistant. The administrative assistant has a chief who works for him.
And you know where he buried the body, right, Dugan?
Bodies, Admiral.
I don't want to know about this, Dugan. But if you get in trouble, you have my phone number.
Thank you, Dugan said. What if I find out something?
Yes, please, Dugan. Keep me posted. I hope this is genuine.
Thank you, sir.
Radioman 3rd Miller walked up to Chief Dugan's desk and handed him a sheet of paper.
This what you've been waiting for, Chief?
Urgent, from Sec Nave, for Officer Commanding, U.S. Navy Base, Mare Island. Attention, Chief Petty Officer Edward B. Dugan, USN. There is no General Fertig in U.S. Army or U.S. Marine Corps. Lieutenant Colonel Wendell W. Fertig, Corps of Engineers, U.S. Army Reserve, reported missing and presumed Japanese POW on the Tan. Lieutenant Colonel Fertig's next of kin, wife, Mrs. Mary Hampton Fertig, Golden, Colorado, DOB 11 May 1905. By direction, SecNav, Houghton, Captain, USN, Administrative Officer to SecNav, by Hansen, CPO, USN. Dugan read the teletype message.
What time is it here when it's 0600 in the Philippines? He asked.
I don't know, Chief.
You don't know? My God, Miller, you're a radioman third. You're supposed to know that kind of thing. Find out and be here when it is.
You know what time it will be here, right?
Of course. I'm a chief.
Dugan stood up and put on his cap and jacket.
I'll be back when I'm back, he said.
You're going to tell the Admiral how to run the war again, right?
Actually, I'm going over to the Presidio to talk the Army into loaning me their Model 94.
Radioman Third Miller put his fingers to his radio telegraph key. KFS to MFS. KFS to MFS. Bye. The reply came immediately. Chief Dugan looked over Miller's shoulder as the words appeared on his typewriter. MFS to KFS, standing by.
Send it, Chief Dugan ordered.
Miller took his right hand from the typewriter keys and put it onto the radio telegraph key. KFS to MFS. Send encrypted, maiden name, Fertig's next of kin, and date of birth, standing by. There was no reply for several minutes.
They're either encoding it or we're talking to the Japs and they're wondering what the hell to do now, Chief Dugan said.
And then there was a reply. MFS to KFS, followed by three encoded lines of five-character groups, repeated, followed with MFS by. Chief Dugan ripped the sheet of paper from Miller's typewriter, walked quickly back to his desk, and operated the Model 94 cryptographic device he had borrowed from the Army at God only knew what cost in future favors to be repaid.
Miller,
he called, and paused a moment as if he was trying to regain control of his voice.
Send, we are ready for your traffic.
No shit? It's for real?
Belay that. Send, welcome to the net. We are ready for your traffic.
Chief Dugan reached for his telephone.
Operator, Chief Dugan, long distance priority code 16B. Get me Mrs. Mary Fertig in Golden, Colorado.
Radioman Third Miller, without stopping his tapping on his key, called over his shoulder.
Chief, you think you should do that without asking somebody?
If I ask somebody, they'd likely tell me not to, Chief Dugan said.
Mrs. Mary Fertig came on the line 2 minutes later.
Mrs. Fertig, this is Chief Dugan, Maury Island Navy Base.
Yes?
Ma'am, I think we have just heard from your husband, General Fertig.
You must be mistaken. My husband is Major Fertig, and he's in the Philippines.
Radioman Miller handed Chief Dugan another sheet of paper and then hurried back to his typewriter.
Ma'am, Chief Dugan said, let me read you something. For Mrs. Fertig, quote, pineapples for breakfast, love, end quote. Does that mean anything to you?
There was a long pause.
Yes, that means something. It means my husband is on the island of Mindanao. We used to go there often to play golf on the Dole plantation. We always had pineapples for breakfast.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there any way I can get a message to my husband?
Yes, ma'am. A short one. What would you like to say? There was another pause.
Please tell him all is well and send love.
Yes, ma'am. I'll try to get that to him right away. ma'am, I'm sure some people will be in touch with you. Maybe when they come to see you, it would be better if you didn't tell them I called you.
I understand. Thank you so very much, Mr. Dugan.
That's Chief Dugan, ma'am. Goodbye, ma'am.
Part 5 1. Office of the Military Governor of Mindanao, Cagayan de Oro, Misami, Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 0900 hours, 13 October, 1942.
My General, Lieutenant Colonel Tange Kisho said to Brigadier General Kurokawa Kenzo, Captain Saikaku has been handling the matter of the clandestine radio station and related matters. With your permission, sir, I will ask him to brief the general.
General Kurokawa nodded and looked at Saikaku. Instead of rising to his feet as Colonel Tange, and perhaps even General Kurokawa, expected him to do, Saikaku carefully set his teacup on the conference table and slumped back against his upholstered chair. He had decided that it was important to appear relatively unconcerned about the existence of this General Fertig and his radio station, and with Hideyori's inability to locate it.
My General, he began. On 10 October, Lieutenant Hideyori's radio operators began hearing a coded message transmitted on the 20-meter shortwave band. Hideyori brought this to my attention. The message was partly in the clear and partly encrypted. It was addressed to U.S. forces in Australia. At my direction, the message was forwarded to the Signals Intelligence Branch in Manila, together with several suggestions of mine to aid in the decryption process. The same day, late in the afternoon, a radio station which we believed to be the U.S. Navy station on Mare Island, California, responded to the station here. That message was also encrypted. There has been a further exchange of messages since then, but let me take this one thing at a time. This morning, Signals Intelligence Branch furnished me with their decryption of the first messages. They informed me the encryption was performed on a U.S. Army cryptograph, two examples of which came into our hands on Luzon. The first message, the one Hideyori's operators intercepted, was quite simple. Quote, we have the hot poop from the hot Yanks in the fills. Fertig, Brig Gen, end quote.
So there is a General Fertig, General Kurokawa interrupted.
We don't know that for sure, General, Saikaku said. I'll touch on that in a moment. The body of the message is in American vernacular. Hot poop is a slang expression meaning roughly fresh information. Hot Yanks in the fields obviously means Yankees in the Philippines.
Hot Yankees? General Kurokawa asked.
I don't know what that means, General. Possibly it refers to the heat. The reply from California told the station here to stand by, be attentive, at 6 the following morning. At that time, the California station asked MFS, the call sign of the station here, to furnish them the maiden name, the name of an unmarried woman's father, of Fertig's next of kin, presumably his wife, and her date of birth. This was furnished.
Obviously, then, there is a Fertig, General Kurokawa said.
Yes, sir. A Fertig, not necessarily a General Fertig. I have been looking into this. Nowhere in captured personnel records is there a record of a General Fertig. There is a record of a Major Fertig believed killed during the Luzon campaign.
The Americans could have infiltrated this man somehow, General Kurokawa said. Or it could be, what is the French phrase, nom de guerre.
With all respect, sir, based on the following messages, I have developed a theory. In my judgment, sir, there was some doubt in the United States about this man's identity. They asked the maiden name and date of birth questions to make him prove who he is.
And?
General Kurokawa asked impatiently. Immediately after the station here furnished the asked-for information, there was a message to Mrs. Fertig. Quote, pine apples for breakfast, love, end quote.
Which you think means what?
The Dole Corporation, as I am sure the General knows, had extensive operations on this island. Pineapples and Mindanao have a meaning. I think it is entirely possible that this Fertig fellow has a connection with the Dole Corporation. He very well might be an executive. He was both further identified